Yeah, they're all really difficult questions. But it can all be distilled into, how do I stop suffering? Just each quite follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Follow the Noble Eightfold Path. Follow the Noble Eightfold Path. So there was three questions from yesterday that were not answered yet, that Ajahn Kirtivemmal circled on his sheet. How do you or other monks deal with grief associated with the passing away of loved ones, especially parents or caretaker, who have been kind to you? Do you also experience crying out in isolation to heal that grief? Whether like crying out in isolation, that's really up to the individual as to whether that would occur or not. It's a hard one to answer. Everybody relates to this differently. So it's not that we don't experience grief. Expressing the grief more doesn't necessarily heal it, but it's more just to it's more like a very sober reflection on impermanence, and then we can bring that into, we can change our perspective a little bit too in order to quote unquote deal with it in terms of rather than, so it's a slight shift in focus. So it's easy to focus on mourning the loss, but we can also focus on celebrating who they were or honoring who they were by doing merit or acts of generosity in their name or dedicating, doing some sort of good deed and dedicating it for them. So actually doing something is helpful. Actually like doing something good and dedicating it to that person can be quite a good way to express gratitude. So thinking of it as an expression of gratitude rather than dealing with grief. So a way to celebrate their life and express gratitude, and also to reflect on that's also going to happen to me. I'm going to die eventually. Everybody without exception is going to pass away. We don't have that long here. So so to really look at what was good about someone's life and do something in their memory can be quite helpful. Are monks in the forest tradition also required to meditate near dead bodies and cremation grounds? Is that to uproot defilements of fear of death? Is it considered psychologically safe as it can be overwhelming stress on the mind? Well, you do need to have some experience with the practice before going into a cremation ground, and you can overcome fear of death, fear of ghosts. One of the Dutanga practices, allowable ascetic practices for bhikkhus, is to live in a cremation ground, to determine to live in a cremation ground for a period of time. But the main impetus or the main reason for living in a cremation ground is the reflection, I too will be like that, I too am of that nature, that will be my body eventually. And it's a reflection on, again, it's the same type of reflection on impermanence. So it's not to be, have like a macabre fascination with dead bodies or seeing them burn and kind of, in order to, you know, we don't want to, if it's psychologically overwhelming, we shouldn't be doing that practice. But Wapananachat is good for this because Wapananachat's eternal ground. So they burn the bodies at Wapananachat and we can spend the night around the cremation pyre and watch the body burn and just reflect on the ordinariness of it. It's incredibly ordinary, actually. It's not like some sort of horror movie or death is the most, as Lungpur Liam said once, death is the most ordinary thing in the world. So it's getting our mind around that and coming to an acceptance that death is something very natural and normal. And that's how we train ourselves to accept that. Can you expand on what is the core wat for how to treat teachers and how to treat guests? That would take quite a while. But if you'd like to see Buddhist Monastic Code 2 by Tanisaro Bhikkhu, Ajahn Jeff, then there's the protocols around the Acharya Watas and Akanduka Watas. There's the different Acharya Watas, things like in the time of the Buddha, putting out water, putting out foot, like preparing a foot washing area, putting out tooth cleaning sticks, putting out kanji if they take kanji in the morning, just basic looking after them, washing their robes. How to treat guests. It depends on the guest. So if it's a lay guest or a monastic guest, you would treat them differently. So say a monastic guest, you would, if they were junior to you, you would just make sure they have a dwelling place. If they're going to come and stay, you make sure they have a dwelling place, make sure that place is clean, lead them there. Make sure they know where the dining hall is, where the Dhamma hall is, where the bathrooms are. And then the duty of that guest is also, if they don't get told those things, their duty is to ask, where are those things? And pretty basic, pretty practical. But if you want to know more, you can check out Buddhist Monastic Code 2. And I'll go into some of these written questions. Could you please elaborate on rules for putting one's hands in Anjali when speaking to a monk at a Bhayagiri? Should the hands be held throughout a conversation, or does it depend on what is being spoken about? Is there something other than respect that one should be holding in one's heart? Abject fear? And what about bowing? It's a weakness in my practice that I would like to improve. It's just, you know, putting the hands in Anjali, even if you don't put your hands in Anjali at all, it's more like seeing how the spirit moves, seeing how the heart moves. It's not like, you could, like when you talk to a senior monk or something, or any monk, you could just, when you start talking, you can put your hands in Anjali and then put them down. Or if you're really feeling it, you could keep your hands up, you know, the whole time. And it's not like, you know, I'm going to stop talking to them because they should have their hands in Anjali when I'm talking to them. And it's really just based on the feeling. There's no rule around it. It's an etiquette in Thailand, in Thai Buddhism. This is something that comes up. Bowing is also based on, we have a, for the monastics, we bow when we come in the hall or when we leave the hall. And it's more like an establishment of mindfulness when we bow. It's not like, you know, you should have a certain level of respect for Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So everyone's at just going to be at where they're at. We can't force ourselves to have faith or force ourselves to throw ourselves on the ground out of absolute faith in the Buddha or in the monks. So, but it's more just, it's a, when we bow, we come to meditate and we bow, and it's a cultivation of mindfulness, and we're setting an intention to do a certain activity, in this case, meditation. When we say get up in the morning, first thing we do, get up, bow to our shrine in the kuti, and then go about our morning, and before we come down, bow before we leave. So it's making every activity very deliberate, and it's like a reestablishing of mindfulness before each activity. When somebody shows you how to do something correctly, but the manner in which they convey the message is rude, what is the most skillful thing you can do to let the person know they were perceived as rude, but also fully and completely absorb the content of their beneficial message? The main question here is oftentimes people do have good suggestions, but the way they communicate them are sometimes not appreciated. And so you may have an inclination to throw the good and bad away. How do you avoid falling into this trap? Yeah, that's also one of the simple pleasures of living in community life. This just happens all the time, this kind of thing. And sometimes maybe people don't even intend to be rude. They don't even intend to be rude, but it's just people, you know, may not have highly honed social skills or highly developed ways of speaking to each other, so that they may actually have an intention to help and not be upset or angry, but still come across that way, or based on our own karma, our own upbringing, and we don't know the people we're living with. Sometimes we're all coming from different areas of the country sometimes and different backgrounds, and so somebody may be totally well-intentioned, but we take it as, oh, we're taken aback, or we think, you know, we take it as like they're being very harsh. And so it's good to actually give people the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, they may actually have had been too strong, or they may actually have something they can work on, but we kind of have to find the right time if we feel comfortable. Or we can also, if something is really serious, we can find a third party to mediate a conversation, a difficult conversation with somebody. And also it's good to reflect, has there ever been times when we spoke like that to somebody? So one way to develop equanimity is to contemplate karma, like, have I ever done that action? Have I ever been that way to somebody else? To my friends or family or kids or whatever, have I ever spoken that way to somebody in terms of pointing something out? So can be a good reflection as well. So it's always two-sided. There's always two sides to every story. It's never just, you know, I'm completely right and they're completely wrong. There's always a mixture. Also, just nonviolent communication is a good thing to study. I always like to recommend that as like right speech, factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is, to let that person know they were perceived as rude, that wouldn't be nonviolent communication. Say, like, going up to someone and saying, you know, what you said to me, I perceived that as rude. So that's like an evaluation or a judgment of another person. But rather, when you pointed this out to me, when you said this to me, I felt dot, dot, dot. I felt hurt. I felt afraid. I felt sad. There was some sort of, so it's like taking responsibility for how we're feeling. Not I felt attacked, because I felt attacked means you're attacking me and I know your intention and I can read your mind. So I felt attacked is not a feeling, but like I felt sad, I felt afraid, I felt like I wanted to hide or whatever. And they may be like, I'm so sorry, I didn't intend that, or they may be like, or maybe they'll, who knows how they'll react, but that can be a good opener. So there's a lot of questions, so I think that's good enough for that one for now. Can you tell us about the history of female monastics or aspirants that stayed at the monastery in the early days and why it didn't work out? A little bit. I don't want to go into the whole thing, but I was in Anagarika, and we had Sister Ajahn's Sundara and Sister Jitendriya living here, and also Sister Tanasanti for a while. They were Siladharas, and it's just it comes up in communities. It's just difficult to have male and female monastics together, and I won't go into the details here because this is a public teaching, but just that it's just coming back to the way the Buddha originally set it up, with separate communities that meet up sometimes, is just so much more efficacious, it seems. But it also wasn't bad. I did have a lot of appreciation for them when I was in Anagarika. How do you understand the phrase, the body within the body? Gosh, there's a lot of ways you could understand that one. There's the body in and of itself. That's one way of thinking of it. Just the body mindfulness, embodied awareness, mindfulness of the body. You can think of it as the sensations in the body, or just keeping the focus just in the body, not too dispersed. Or bodies within bodies. So, you could focus on one aspect or one part. If there's pain coming up in the body, or there's tension or anxiety somewhere, that's one. That's kind of how I work with it. But it's, there's just probably 1,000 different ways you could interpret that. But there's no, for all these things in Buddhism, it's not like there's a right answer where you can say, like, multiple choice exam, this is the right one and you got it right and now you have panya, now you have wisdom. It's dynamic. But the Buddha's pointing to a dynamic, panya or wisdom is a discernment, is a dynamic quality which allows us to live in a flow of dropping things and letting go and not picking things up. So it's not like you just like get the answer right and then everything falls away. But it's training, it's learning to live in a way where we don't pick things up that are suffering, that are problematic. Gosh, difficult questions. What duty do we have to parents who often act foolishly and use harmful and abusive language? Jeez. When questions like this get asked, I'm kind of hoping that those parents aren't sitting in the room. So, but I can't think of anyone here who acts this way right now. But you never know. When people leave the monastery, maybe they're like different people. They're on their best behavior in the monastery. I remember, I won't tell that story. I guess the duty would be reflect on it, reflect on the relationship. Also, just like earlier, like, have we ever acted in that way? Can we say, I've never been that way, that they are to me? You know, I've never, ever been that way. So to reflect on it and see, like, always bringing it back to ourselves, because we have, that's what we can train, that's what we can work with. We can't, or we, it's nearly impossible to go around changing other people or outside situations, but we can change ourselves and thereby set a good example and thereby have like that ripple out effect and be a good example for people, have a good influence on people. That we can do. So we can train ourselves, we can work on ourselves. So that's our duty. That's also our duty. We can not act foolishly and use harmful and abusive language. You know, we can, we have the power to change that. I think like my dad's dad's stepdad, my grandpa's stepdad was from a Mormon from Salt Lake City who had the view that you have to beat the devil out of your children. And my grandpa had very dark skin because of his own ancestry, and so that he was beaten more than the other kids. They were all beaten because they all had the devil in them, but he was beaten perhaps more. But he made a conscious decision to not treat his own children that way, and he was always unbelievably kind to his children. And so that was to like my own dad and his brother and sister. So you know, you think you don't have to keep that going or keep perpetuating that. Can you please describe the main stages of insight meditation? Thank you. Again, without getting into hours and hours, whole treatise, I mean, these kind of things can be found in the suttas, but also it's different traditions describe it in different ways. So we might have like the Vipassana, the Goenka tradition might describe it in one way. Tibetan tradition might describe it in one way. Visuddhimagga, or really, it really comes back to experience. So even though this isn't a question about dependent origination, or paticca-samuppada, I think it is similar to something Lungpo Cha said, that, you know, it's like, just look at dukkha, just look at suffering, just look at dukkha, keep it simple. It's like when you're falling out of a tree and you're trying to count the branches as you go down, and you can't count. It's just happening too fast. You can't count the branches as you're falling, but when you hit the bottom, you know it hurts. That's what you can know. So, and you look at that. How can I not fall out of that tree again? How can I avoid that suffering in the future? So in terms of the main stages of insight meditation, it's really, we can describe it perhaps in a certain way according to there's these seven stages of insight or whatever. We could explain it in an academic way and list what's in the book or what's translated from Pali or Sanskrit in the books. But coming back to our own experience, how's our practice of not picking things up? How's our practice of forgiving? How's our practice of the precepts, what do we do, how do we react when in the meditation, when a difficult mental state or anger or greed or some sort of proliferation that won't calm down, how do we deal with that? So that's insight, is when we see the suffering of that. That's why the Buddha's just really trying to drive the point home all the time of this is suffering, this is the ending of suffering. That's all I teach. All I teach is suffering and the ending of suffering. All I teach is dukkha and the ending of dukkha. So it's when the heart, on a very deep level, really sees this is dukkha, then it can't pick it up because it's like fire. It can't. When you see a fire, you're not going to be able to will yourself to put your hand in the fire, or you might, but you're going to retract it immediately. And when you put your hand in a fire, and your hand is in a fire and it's burning you, you don't need to consult a manual and say, like, what are the stages of getting my hand out of this fire? Like, maybe I need to check and see how to do it. You don't need to do that. Your hand is automatically out of the fire. So the heart is the same, the citta is the same with insight and with the seeing of dukkha. It can't be in a fire, it can't be in the fire anymore. It'll retract itself because it sees the suffering of it, but because there's still ignorance and delusion, then it doesn't see how it's tormenting itself, so it's still burning away in there. So in terms of insight, I think that's how I try to think about it in terms of experientially and trying to see the dukkha aspect of these different proliferations and these different mental states that are arising. And again, it's not about stopping the mental state or stopping the proliferation. It's about seeing the dukkha in it. So that's a really vital point, because if we try to just stop it or stamp it out, then we're not seeing the dukkha of it. And actually trying to stop it and stamp it out in itself is also dukkha. So we have to step back and see, where's the dukkha? Where's the dukkha in this? And the desire, how's the tanha operating here? What is the illumination that appears during sitting meditation, please? Is it the false or the true? Is it from inside or outside or neither, please? Thank you. I don't know. I think I might. This one might have been answered in the previous question. It's kind of a little bit. It's just coming back to that dukkha aspect rather than waiting for something to happen. So sitting meditation just. Waiting for some sort of illumination or bright light or get struck by a giant purple lightning bolt or whatever idea we have that's supposed to happen to us. This reminds me of somebody who stayed here a long time ago, and they were practicing a lot, and then they were asking what they should contemplate, and I mentioned like they could try contemplating impermanence, and then a few days later, they at a Q&A tea time, they said, well, I contemplated impermanence and nothing happened. Well, I said, well, what did you want to happen? So I don't know, I just thought something was supposed to happen. Like, I contemplate impermanence and something happens. So, well, if it was that easy, then there would be a lot more meditators in the world and a lot more people practicing. So, yes, perhaps we can think of illumination in terms of seeing dukkha can lead to illumination. Seeing craving, seeing tanha, seeing the whole process can lead to illumination. But then when we ask questions like, is it false or the true? You know, things like that, it's just tying ourselves up in knots. It's like we're good at kind of confounding ourselves. So just keeping it very simple, like the awareness of the breath, breathing in, breathing out, just looking at trying to give rise, motivation's very important, like giving rise to what we want is a sense of ease, and what that comes from is seeing clearly, you know, seeing with mindfulness, seeing dukkha. And if it arises, it doesn't really matter whether it's from inside or outside or neither. So this is a shift in focus. So rather than trying to answer what is it, we want to, the scientific mind wants to know what is it. But even if what is it gets answered, that doesn't keep the dukkha from arising. So there's a bit of a misunderstanding in the heart, and we all have this. that if we might think, just if I got the answer, what is it? Then I'll be okay. Then it'll be better. Then I'll know what it is. But there'll still be that mental factor of seeking there, and that's dukkha. So trying to shift the focus into looking at that is quite important. There's a very long question here now about Burma, Myanmar, and I'm not going to answer it just because it's kind of a never-ending conversation, or you know, how to save the world from people who are crazy and ignorant. So again, just coming back to that idea, we can't. One is we have to realize that when we see things on the news or people tell us things, it's always not a sure thing that that's what's exactly happening. We really have to go there or know for ourselves. And two, we can only really take responsibility for ourselves. So, you know, if the Buddha really set that example, he spoke out in the suttas against war, and there was going to be a big battle between his homeland and a neighboring state over water rights, and the Buddha recommended they don't fight, they don't go to war. But when they did, he didn't intervene. He didn't try to stop them. You would think that, well, he's the Buddha, you know, he can take his psychic powers and go fly out over the battlefield and make everybody stop fighting. But that wasn't what happened. And so really our duty is to set the example. And the world belongs to Mara. The world is the realm of death. And this is, it's always just going to be, there's always going to be pain. It's always going to be unsatisfactory in this way. It's not condoning bad things that happen in the world, but it's doing what we can in ourselves, the sila, samadhi, panya, the practice, doing what we can to set an example, doing what we can to get the message of peace and understanding out there. But that's all we can do. At a certain point, we have to say, we have to be rest content saying, I did everything I could. And that's good. That's good to do everything we can. That's so much better than just bemoaning a situation or complaining endlessly about it to everybody who is around us. Also, as a side note, that's like why people request, we don't go and talk Dhamma to anybody. We actually only speak when it's requested. So it's the same with anything, not just with Dhamma. So with the world or politics or anything, it's nice to not speak to somebody about it unless they ask you about it. Then it'll be more efficacious as well. So if somebody really wants to know what you have to say about it, they'll ask. But please, it's very good to make a practice of not proselytizing in that sense either. So very, very kind of important to apply the Dhamma to situations like this. Okay, I'm answering questions longer than I normally do. If we don't have a Sangha close to where we live, should we move to a different place, or are online Sanghas good enough? And can non-Buddhist people be part of your Sangha, or does that not count as Sangha? No, they have to be Buddhist, and they have to keep their hands in Anjali all the time. For example, my mom is very supportive but is not a Buddhist. Could she be part of my Sangha anyways? Yeah, I mean, anybody. Sangha just means community, so community of practitioners, community of friends who are supporting each other. What does it mean to be a Buddhist anyway? The for us to be a card-carrying Buddhist is 3 refuges and 5 precepts. So those 5 precepts, not one of those precepts is, you know, you have to have absolute belief in the Buddha. It's just don't kill, don't steal, don't commit sexual misconduct, don't lie, don't take intoxicants. So it's that upright living, kindness, basic kindness, upright living, integrity. And somebody who, when the Dalai Lama was asked, like, how do we convert people to Buddhism? Somebody asked the Dalai Lama, how do I convert people to Buddhism? And he said, you don't convert people to Buddhism. If we're doing any converting, it's converting from suffering to happiness. It's converting from unskillfulness to skillfulness. That's all we care about. That's all we're trying to do. Next question. It seems that monks have a pretty strict schedule. What is the purpose of this? I used to set myself really strict schedules so I wouldn't have to think about what to do next. I no longer have a strict schedule, and it's tough to adjust. Wondering what to do next can be overwhelming and stressful, but a super strict schedule made me feel like I was a robot sometimes. So I wonder what you'd suggest in terms of scheduling one's daily life, and if you could talk about why monks have such a strict daily routine. Thank you so much. Well, I mean, yeah, every monastery is different, and we do, you know, we meditate at 5 a.m., and we do our chanting and meditation, just having a basic structure, but it gets switched up sometimes. Sometimes we have periods of self-retreat where it's totally unstructured. Come down for the meal, bring our food back up to our hut, and eat in solitude and just have no structure at all. So there are times when it's structured, there's times when it's not structured, and it's all for just seeing the mind. So we don't want to overly structure ourselves. We don't want to be overly reliant on, you know, making sure everything is just a certain way so we can feel okay. We don't want to have, like, too many. We do have a lot of rules. The monks have 227 rules. We have a lot of different protocols, but they're all very practical. And it's not about as being as tight or as strict as possible in and of itself. And so it's also, you know, keeping that edge, just on the edge of our comfort zone and pushing the boundaries of our comfort zone. That's how we do with, like, the lunar observance days, where we stay up later in meditation on those days. And just things like simplicity, like eating the main meal at 11 and not having dinner, for example. That's just simplicity. It's not like we're trying to torture ourselves. And when the schedule is very unstructured, then looking at what that's like, so actually seeing what is it like when I sleep as much as I want to and don't get up in the morning for chanting or whatever, and how does that affect the mind? So we start to see what's actually a good balance. So, you know, all of us, many of us, not all of us, but many of us have probably tried, like, going on retreat and then, okay, I'm just going to sleep as much as I want and then I'll feel better than I do now. But actually, you feel worse if you sleep too much. You can only, that's dukkha as well. So starting to see the dukkha of sleeping too much, and that there's actually less dukkha, less bodily and mental dukkha, when you sleep just the right amount. Or even when you push your sleep schedule a little bit and go outside of your comfort zone, you see that mind gets bright. Mind actually gets brighter sometimes when one pushes through that kind of tiredness or what one thinks one needs. How many, you know, we might even have sheets that say, like, I need to sleep a certain number of hours each night, and if I don't tick off those hours, I don't use my sleep app on my phone or whatever, and then I won't be okay. I won't feel okay if I don't, you know, achieve those that sleep app, predetermined, whatever. And it's just to push the envelope a little bit, but it's not to be like unbelievably heroic or to make some sort of huge spiritual achievement, what we call spiritual athletics. And we're not like having an austerity competition or anything, but it's just seeing what works, what's the balance, like Lungpa said in his talk, like padi, what's padi, what's just right, dhamma is what's just right. So schedule is just helping us to discover that. During the Q&A, during the Q&A yesterday afternoon, I heard one of the recommendations to set a boundary. I feel that creating a boundary is falling into the category of the five hindrances, isn't it? Buddha taught us to practice the four Brahmaviharas, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, which are boundless. Please clarify why we need to set a boundary. Why don't we practice four Brahmaviharas instead? Sadhu. So, yeah, those are sometimes we're not at that level. Maybe we're not advanced enough to be able to encompass somebody who's coming at us with anger or some sort of negativity, or really, we really do need to set a boundary to just fully encompass them with boundless loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, joy. It doesn't always work. We do need to set boundaries sometimes. And for myself, I've always been very bad at setting boundaries, and I have suffered from this in the past. But then, of course, as a leadership position, having done this for a few years now, I've found that setting boundaries is almost like a self-preservation necessity, and it doesn't preclude having metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. Sometimes setting a boundary is metta for the other person. They're going to harm themselves by what they're about to do to you or whatever. So actually setting a boundary, and actually it's like a little child who's running across the street and into the cars. You jump and yank them back, even if it injures or harms them, or a child who's choking and you put your finger down their throat, even if it's going to harm them, but you're going to save their life. Or somebody's doing something to you and you're going to save their life and your own life. You know, they might be pulling you over a cliff with them. So it is okay to actually set boundaries. And I had an experience with this where I actually surprised myself by setting a very firm boundary with somebody last year. And it actually, it was actually, you know, I felt like it was the right thing to do, the right decision. And it was a protection for both people in the end. So setting boundaries, it doesn't, you know, it is kind of like get confounding oneself to try to like roll that into the five hindrances, or really it's just a way of being that's necessary sometimes. Okay, two more questions, and it's 4:30. Three more questions. I'll leave those for to be answered tomorrow. So, okay. So.